Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, Lake City, Florida, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming at ironsharpensironradio.com. This is Chris Arnson, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron, wishing you all a happy Monday on this 24th day of July, 2017. And it is my honor and privilege to have on the program for the very first time ever on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, Dr. Micah Edmondson. He has earned his Ph.D. in systematic theology at Calvin Theological Seminary, and he's the author of The Power of Unearned Suffering, The Roots and Implications of Martin Luther King Jr.'s Theodicy. He is also pastor of New City Fellowship Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And today we are going to be addressing Martin Luther King Jr., an open and honest evaluation of his life, legacy, and theology. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you to for the very first time to Iron Sharpens Iron, Dr. Micah Edmondson.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity. It's my honor and my privilege to be able to participate, and I hope that the conversation will serve the listeners well and bring honor and glory to the Lord.
Amen. And in studio with me is my co-host, the Reverend Buzz Taylor.
And hello once again. Good to be here.
And if anybody would like to join us on the air with a question today, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Please give us at least your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the USA. And please only remain anonymous if it's about a personal and private matter that you are asking about. And again, it's chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Well, Dr. Micah, as I typically do when I interview people, especially for the very first time, I like to have them give a summary of their own testimony of salvation, about how and what kind of religious atmosphere, if any, you were raised in, what providential circumstances the Sovereign Lord brought about in your life that drew you to himself and saved you, and then how you came to be a pastor in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church denomination.
All right. Thank you so much, brother. I like to begin by simply saying, hey, I'm a grace case, brother. And as we all are, I am definitely a grace case. And I was saved by grace through faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. And because of his righteousness and merits alone do I have any standing before the Lord. I was born and raised in Nashville, Tennessee, East Nashville, and we were members of the Mount Gilead Missionary Baptist Church down in Nashville, and we were kind of Mother's Day, Easter, Christmas type folks that made an occasional appearance at church. I thank the Lord for that. Those opportunities that I had to engage the community of faith, but I was at that time I was a Christian in name only, and it was not until my junior year of college I went off to Hampton University, which is a historically black college in Virginia, and I was actually a physics major, and I was studying applied physics with a track toward getting my B.S. in applied physics, when a physics colleague who happened to be a Pentecostal brother and and minister in his church and drummer in his church, invited me out to a revival. And I kind of had enough sort of religious sense, there's a very strong sense of civil religion within the African-American community, and I had enough sort of just civil religion and a religious sense to say, you know, yes, I'm not going to refuse this invitation to go to church, even though at that time I was not living for the Lord. My life was completely consumed with my own ambition and myself, and I certainly was not denying myself in any way to follow Christ. But at that time, I said, well, look, oh, sure, I'll come out to this, you know, revival and do my religious duty, and that'll be that. Well, I had no idea that I would have an encounter with the Lord at that revival. And I was there, and it was an amazing service, actually. Not the kind of service that we might have, you know, I'm a Presbyterian now. And it's not necessarily the kind of the denomination or kind of situation that we might have in our church today, but the gospel was preached, and it was and the Lord was at work through the preaching of the gospel, and I realized at that service that Christ had been crucified and risen to save sinners like me, and that if I would bow before him in faith and in repentance, that he would save me. And I did, man. I threw myself upon the mercy of Christ, and the whole trajectory of my life changed from that night. And that's not just, and I don't believe, you know, I don't believe in Christian perfection, at least not on this side of glory. And so I still had major issues, you know, but the trajectory was changed, you know, and my striving was changed. And although I had a lot of selfishness in my life, and I still do have a lot of selfishness in my life, it was a struggle now against sin. And I was battling against the flesh and seeking to follow the Lord. So that's where the Lord found me. And how he saved me. So.
Amen. Well, how did you discover and embrace the doctrines of Reformed theology?
Oh boy, it's interesting. You know, it's amazing because although I did not grow up in an environment that was self-consciously Reformed, there was if you hang around that Bible long enough, right, and you actually look at it hard enough, because Reformed theology is really biblical theology, and if you look at it long enough and read it enough and dig around it enough, you'd be surprised at the truth that the Lord will reveal to you and that you will proclaim, even if you don't self-consciously think of yourself as Reformed. And so when I came to faith, I still had some things that were sort of sewed into my understanding from my days back at Mount Gilead. And so I kind of already had a sense of the perseverance of the saints. You know I actually just assumed when the Lord saved me, I assumed that everybody had, you know, believed that that if the Lord saves you, he will keep you. You know, because that was the kind of Jesus that I was serving, a keeper. You know, and I was like, hey, I had a deep awareness of my own sin, and I knew that if this thing was ever going to work out, it was not going to be by my own strength and by my own faithfulness to Christ, but by his faithfulness to me. And so I kind of had that already in my background. But I still had not really sort of explicitly encountered Reformed theology. Later on, going off to seminary, I embraced the call of the ministry. After I graduated from Hampton with my degree in physics, I went off to study astronomy at the University of Rochester. And it was there, I was in a doctoral program for astronomy, and it was there that I actually began to deeply wrestle with the call of ministry. And I actually ended up leaving the doctoral program at the University of Rochester, much to the chagrin of my agnostic advisor, who told me that I was going off to study fairy tales and made me take a leave of absence and said, you will be back, you know. That was back in 2002, so that's been 15 years ago, you know, and I still have not come back, you know. So I ended up going off into seminary, and when I went to seminary, I ended up going into what we might call liberal seminaries. So I went into Rochester Crozier Divinity School, which is in Rochester, New York. Ended up starting Divinity School there because that was very close to the University of Rochester. And then my wife and I, we wanted to be closer to home. We were newly married. We were married a week after graduation. We moved to Rochester. I shifted to go to Crozier. When I went to Crozier, my wife during that time had finished up her degree. She did a degree in marriage and family therapy, a master's degree there at the University of Rochester. And so we wanted to have children and that kind of thing. And so we decided we wanted to be closer to home, transferred down to Vanderbilt Divinity School. And when I got to Vanderbilt, I had this at Colgate, but especially when I got to Vanderbilt, I was confronted with, I mean, you talk about liberalism. It was hardcore, man. And it was like, you know, you couldn't assume anything. You know, they were there to undermine. If you had a shred of orthodoxy, you know, some folks that were trying to take it away from you, you know. And what I needed at that time was I needed a biblical and intellectually robust articulation of the faith that helped me to navigate these thorny questions and these thorny issues, you know. It was interesting because, so I was there, and it was my, it was like my, maybe my first year there, my second semester at Vandy, and I was in the parking lot of a grocery store. And I was listening to the radio, and there was a show called Renewing Your Mind by a guy named R.C. Sproul. And this is a common story especially a lot of African American reform folk. They are, you know, somehow in their story, R.C. Sproul's name almost always comes up. And I was just happened to be sitting in his car, and man, he had a show on heresies, on ancient heresies. And he was talking about these different heresies that had arisen in the life of the early church, and he was talking about it with the same depth and sophistication that I had heard in my early church history class at Vanderbilt. And I'm like, who is this guy? He's giving out this stuff on the radio. You know, I'm paying good money for this, and this guy's giving it out on the radio. And not just that, he not only was he doing that, but he was pointing it to he also had a very rich engagement with the gospel and how the gospel answered these issues and how the gospel was the tool by which was the power by which the Lord preserved his church by his spirit through his gospel and so I was astounded, and I wrote to the show. I said, hey, I don't know what kind of Christian this guy is. I don't know what tradition he's from, but I got to get more of this stuff. And I found out, you know, that he's Reformed and Presbyterian. And so from that point on, I was hooked. I was like, anything I could get my hands on, anybody that's dead or living that's Reformed Presbyterian, I'm eating it up. So Spurgeon, you know, I mean, all the Puritan, man. And so I just got my hands on anything. And so that was sort of my entryway into Reformed theology, sort of self-conscious, so in a self-conscious way.
Well, I'm glad that you threw in one Reformed Baptist, Charles Spurgeon, in your
hey, no, man. Hey, the Prince of Preachers, brother. You can't.
Accidents will happen.
Yeah, my Presbyterian co-host says foolish things so often that I have to keep his mic.
He had me all along through there. That was
great. That's all right, man. That's all right.
But even he knows that he loves Charles Spurgeon privately. Anyway,
that's right, man. I mean, I just and I should say this. There's one other thing. so eventually, so when I graduated from Vanderbilt, I went to serve a church in Nashville. Actually, the church I grew up in, the Mount Gilead Missionary Baptist Church, they had called a pastor a few years earlier who was a Calvinistic Baptist. And he had a connection with a group of black Calvinistic Baptists in the Southeast known as the Sovereign Grace Brethren. And there's a guy named Elder D.J. Ward.
Yes, I saw D.J. Ward preach on several occasions at the Bunyan Conference in Lewisburg,
Pennsylvania. Oh, man, what a preacher.
Yeah.
When people come up to me and they say, oh, you know, we enjoyed that stuff, I said, no, you didn't hear Elder Ward preach. And that brother could preach it. And so, but, you know, the thing that I loved about that expression of Reformed theology was that it led with grace. I learned Reformed theology as a grace theology, as a comfort and hope theology, as a theology of biblical exposition, and so that sort of set that helped to determine my sort of approach to it. I always knew it as a grace theology, that sort of set the trajectory for me. I ended up serving at Mount Gilead for a few years. My wife finished. She was actually at that time had entered a doctoral program for counseling psychology, and when she needed to finish that program during an internship, and that caused us to move from Nashville to Louisville, Kentucky, and then we stayed there for about a year, and then from Louisville, Kentucky, my wife finished up her degree, and I wanted to pursue a doctorate in systematic theology, and I came to Calvin. So that's kind of how we got here to Grand Rapids and how I got to Calvin.
Now, were you trying to really, really, really stand out by becoming ordained in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Long live Mason, right? Well, the thing was that when we got here, when we got to Grand Rapids, Michigan, I was a Calvinistic Baptist, and I had gotten connected with other Reform in some Reformed Baptist circles here in Grand Rapids, and it was my intention to take the riches of this this wonderful Reformed tradition back into Black Baptist circles, because I had a burden that if the folks that grew up like I grew up could hear the gospel, could hear the gospel articulated in this way, right, in a language that they could kind of understand and get with, they would love this stuff. I mean, they would just love it. And I thought, man, that was my burden when I got here, and that's what I attempted to do when I got here. In fact, I candidated at a church here in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and got rejected. The folk told me, no, we don't.
Wow.
We don't want you. And it was a humbling experience. And then there was a whole bunch of other resumes that I sent out that just went off into the ether and never came back. And I don't know what happened to them. You know, the folks just never gave me a call back. And so I was kind of in limbo. Like, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? But it was around that time that I was taking a class by a guy named Richard Muller, and he's a historical theologian. This brother is like the expert on the 16th century. He wrote a series of books called Post-Reformation Reformed Dogmatics, and they are just a wealth of knowledge. And I took a class from him on covenant theology, and that kind of sort of was the beginning of the end of my Baptist day. I ended up taking that class and I read a dissertation by a guy named Brandon Jones, actually a Baptist by the name of Brandon Jones, who wrote a dissertation on Baptist sacramental theology, where he actually goes through and unfolds theologies of baptism amongst Calvinistic Baptists. And does a wonderful job, but the thing about Brandon is Brandon kind of pokes the holes in a lot of people. He did a great job in sort of poking holes in their theology. But then I read through it, I thought, man, I've got all the holes poked into this thing, and And then I didn't quite get them all plugged back in. So I was left out with some issues that got unresolved for me. Now, Brandon offers a wonderful, his own version of a theology of baptism. And Brandon is, just a solid brother. He's got, I think, a book on the subject as well that's very helpful. But that book, that dissertation, that before it was a book, the dissertation really helped me to begin to navigate these issues. And I went back in, and I began to look at what the Westminster Confession of Faith actually had to say about baptism and what Presbyterians had to say about baptism. And I had a pastor, a local church pastor by the name of Dale Van Dyke, who pastors Harvest Orthodox Presbyterian Church. And Pastor Dale began to, in a very kind of unassuming type way, challenge me on my theology of baptism and began to ask me certain questions that I just couldn't answer. So that kind of provoked me to do some more investigation. And much to my surprise, I had no intention on ever becoming a Presbyterian. That was the last thing on my mind. But much to my surprise, having looked at the confessions and looked at the scriptures, I was convinced of covenant baptism, of infant baptism, and paedobaptism. And so I ended up on the Presbyterian side of things. And I think Pastor Dale was shocked, too, because he's like, look, nobody ever changes. He told me that going in. Because I'm going to have these conversations, and you're going to go back, and I'm going to go back. But nobody ever really changes this thing, you know. And much to his surprise, I said, hey, man, I think I'm convinced of paedobaptism. He said, what? He was like, what? He's like, oh, I'm shocked.
Well, here I was worried about talking about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and now I find out I should have been worried about baptism discussions. That's quite all right. I love my Reformed Baptist beliefs, but I am very charitable and in inviting others on that disagree with me.
Except sometimes.
Yeah, and a lot of my mentors, are Baptist brothers. Kevin Smith.
Yes.
Kevin L. Smith is I love this brother. He was my pastor. He's really in many ways still my pastor. He was my pastor in Louisville, Kentucky. And we were in Louisville, Kentucky in 2008. And for the 9 years since we have left, he has continued to pastor me. He has continued to be a wonderful mentor. And a big part of the reason I'm a pastor today is because of Kevin L. Smith. So I have great love for my Baptist brothers and sisters. We have a number of Baptists within our congregation at New City Fellowship, and we don't want to make it harder to join New City than it is to join the Kingdom of God. So if you're in the Kingdom, if you're following the Lord and love Jesus and believe in the gospel, come on, you know.
Amen.
So.
And in fact, one thing I'd like to, in retort to my co-host, Reverend Buzz's disparaging remark about Charles Spurgeon, one of my dearest friends since the late 1980s, Pastor Bill Shishko of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Franklin Square, who is now retired from pastoral ministry and is a domestic missionary with Reformation Metro New York. But anyway, he, around the dinner table with his wife and children, and I was there, and I was invited to spend the weekend there not long ago when I was visiting New York, my homeland, and every night his Pastor Bill, along with his wife and children, after the meal is finished at the table, they have a Charles Spurgeon devotional, and they call it they specifically call him Pastor Spurgeon, and so this is just to heap the salt into your now gaping wounds.
I have morning and evening. Does that count?
Yes. I got a morning and evening app on my phone right now.
There you go. I drew the line before that.
And Kevin Smith, I want to urge everybody to look up a sermon that he gave, a really powerful sermon on Election Day at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I'm assuming that if you just Googled Kevin Smith's sermon at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary on Election Day, you would come up with that, unless you know of a more direct link, Dr. Micah, but that was a really powerful message that he gave. And
absolutely.
And I remember during one of our private discussions, he was the individual who gave you the book Glory Road, and as I mentioned to you in my old show in New York, I interviewed each and every one of those authors for the book Glory Road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm assuming he was the one that was a member of D.J. Ward's church that introduced you to D.J. Ward's preaching?
Well, see, okay, so at the so the guy that actually introduced me to Elder Ward was a guy named Roger Glatt, who was the pastor at Mount Gilead at the time. Now, I met, it's interesting because as the way it worked out was that I got to know Elder Ward in the last years of his life. And so I actually met Pastor Kevin Smith at Elder Ward's funeral.
Wow.
We traveled to Mount Gilead. We all got in a bus and we traveled to Lexington, Kentucky, to the Main Street Baptist Church in Lexington, Kentucky, where he served. And it was there that I met Pastor Smith. And immediately we just kind of, you know, we knew each other, kind of, we sort of met each other, and, you know, it was a very emotional time. I mean, Elder Ward was such a powerful, prolific, amazing pastor that, you know, we didn't do a whole, wasn't a lot of small talk going on at that funeral, you know, but we got a chance to meet each other, and when Christina and I, my wife and I, we moved to Louisville, we knew that we wanted to look up Pastor Smith, and he was pastoring the Watson Memorial Baptist Church at the time, and we attended that service and never looked back. I mean, we went there the first Sunday in Louisville, we went to the Watson Memorial Baptist Church, and after we heard Pastor Smith preach, and after we had got to experience the great love of that beautiful church, we knew we didn't have to go anywhere else. We were home, and so that began a great relationship. And as I said, Pastor Smith has pastored me from far and mentored me ever since. You know, he's just an amazing. I've learned so much about pastoral ministry, about preaching, about just being a disciple from Pastor Smith. So anybody that, you know, anybody, I mean, anything, any sermon you get from him, yeah, certainly the election sermon. There's another one I think that's really popular called Wimps Need Not Apply, where he, at the Southern Seminary, because he taught history and homiletics for a time at Southern Seminary. Anybody that wants to look up those sermons, man, you're going to be blessed. And anything from Elder Ward, there's a lot of things, there's been kind of a resurgence of interest in Elder D.J. Ward because there's some things that, Together for the Gospel, I think, this major conference, they featured some clips from some of his sermons, and people were like, who is this guy? This is amazing, and at that time, you know, Elder Ward had died, you know, before that, but there became this huge resurgence of interest in his sermons and in his life, and so you can look up Elder D.J. Ward and find, you know, any number of sermons, and any one that you get is going to be powerful.
And speaking of powerful sermons, how do our listeners, other than just looking up your name on YouTube, how do our listeners get a hold of your phenomenal series on Galatians? I've only heard one of the messages, and that was phenomenal, so I'm assuming the rest of it's phenomenal. But that was really a powerful sermon that you preached in that series on Galatians. How can our listeners most easily listen to those?
Oh, thank you so much, brother. I really appreciate that. If you look up, if you go on YouTube and you look up New City Fellowship, Grand Rapids, there's a YouTube page that has most of the Galatians series. But our website has all of the Galatians series. I've been a pastor of New City for 3 years. We started out as a church plant. We recently became particularized, which is a huge, just big old Presbyterian word. It just means now we're an organized church, and the denomination recognizes us as an organized church rather than a church plant. So, but I've been pastoring New City for about 3 years, and during that time, I've preached through Ezra, I've preached through Mark, And I preach through Galatians, and I'm preaching through Genesis right now. So those are the sermon series that you can find. NewCityGR.org. NewCityGR.org.
Great. Well, we're going to go to our first break right now. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question for Dr. Micah Edmondson, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, city and state, and country of residence if you live outside the USA. And please only remain anonymous if it's about a personal and private matter. And when we return, we will begin our journey into how Dr. Edmondson began to research the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and what drove him to his decision to write his doctoral dissertation on Dr. King. And we'll be taking your questions. We already have a number of people waiting to have your questions asked and answered, but please be patient as we allow the next segment to be dominated by Dr. Edmondson explaining his study of the life of Dr. King and his doctoral dissertation on that subject, and specifically the theodicy involved in Dr. King's life. The theodicy, when we use that term, we're speaking of the defending the goodness of God in the midst of a world filled with suffering and sin and evil. And so therefore you're going to be hearing about how he, Dr. Edmondson, is applying that issue to the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And we are going to try to be as open and honest in both the pros and the cons in this issue. Too often when there are heroes involved in a discussion, they are either idolized or vilified, and we're going to try our best to let the facts speak for themselves. And we look forward to hearing from you and your questions for Dr. Edmondson at some point after we return from these messages from our sponsor. So don't go away.
One sure way all Iron Sharpens Iron radio listeners can help keep my show on the air is to support my advertisers. I know you all use batteries every day, so I'm urging you all from now on to exclusively use BatteryDepot.com for all your battery needs. At BatteryDepot.com, they're changing the status quo. They're flipping the script. They're sticking it to the man. In other words, they'd like to change the battery industry for good by providing an extensive inventory of top-of-the-line batteries that are uniformly new, dependable, and affordable. Ordering from BatteryDepot.com ensures you'll always get fresh out-of-the-box batteries you can count on to work properly at competitive prices. Whether you need batteries for cordless phones, cell phones, radios, PCs, laptops, tablets, baby monitors, hearing aids, smoke detectors, credit card readers, digital cameras, electronic cigarettes, GPSs, MP3 players, watches, or nearly anything else you own that needs batteries, go to BatteryDepot.com. Next day shipping available. All products protected by 30-day guarantees and 6-month warranties. Call 866-403-3768. That's 866-403-3768. Or go to BatteryDepot.com. That's BatteryDepot.com.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Have Have you been blessed by Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? We remain on the air because of our faithful sponsors and because of listeners like you. There are four ways you can help. First, do you know potential sponsors who may wish to advertise their goods or services on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? Second, whenever possible, purchase the products or use the services that our sponsors advertise. And then let them know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Thirdly, you can also donate to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio by going to our website at ironsharpensironradio.com and click support at the top of the page. But most importantly, keep Iron Sharpens Iron Radio in your prayers. We hope that Iron Sharpens Iron Radio blesses you for many years to come.
Welcome back. We were having difficulty with the last advertisement we were trying to air. Sorry about that, but these technical things...
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting
there it
you
is.
To tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Welcome back. That is the very pastor that we were discussing earlier with Dr. Micah Edmondson and my co-host, Reverend Buzz Taylor, Pastor Bill Shishko, formerly the pastor of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church of Franklin Square, Long Island, New York, and now domestic missionary for Reformation Metro New York, a ministry of the Orthodox Presbyterian denomination. Today, if you've just tuned us in, our guest today for the full 2 hours, with about 90 minutes to go, is Dr. Micah Edmondson, who earned his Ph.D. in systematic theology at Calvin Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Power of Unearned Suffering, The Roots and Implications of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Theodicy, and that is Dr. Micah Edmondson's doctoral dissertation in print, and he is a pastor at New City Fellowship Orthodox Presbyterian Church of Grand Rapids, Michigan. Our topic of discussion today is Martin Luther King Jr., an open and honest evaluation of his life, legacy, and theology. And if you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. I wanted to pick up now, Dr. Edmondson, on your interest in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that was so strong that it led you to want to write your dissertation on the subject of his life, specifically about the theodicy involving his life. And it's a no-brainer that young African-American man would be interested in Dr. King. In fact, I would say that in the 21st century, regardless of one's race, folks across the board are interested in some level in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He is revered as a hero, an American hero, by many across the spectrum of not only race and ethnicity, but even political perspectives. You have, in this day and age, conservatives often quoting Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Sometimes it's because they are involved in the pro-life movement, and they bring up Dr. King when he made statements that reveal his belief in the sanctity of life, even before birth and so on. But what was it that really captured your mind and led you forward to a deeper investigation?
Thank you for asking, brother. Well, actually, believe it or not, it was not my intention to do a dissertation on Dr. King. believe it or not. I actually, while in doctoral program at Calvin, it was my intention to do a dissertation on a guy named James Cone. I don't know how much you all may know about Cone, but he's considered to be kind of the father of black liberation theology.
How do you spell the last name?
And, Cone, C-O-N-E.
Okay.
C-O-N-E, James Cone.
Okay.
James Cone. And you know, he wrote a book in 1969 called Black Theology and Black Power, and it was really a theological articulation of the Black Power movement. And it was my intention to write a dissertation on Cone's theology of the atonement. And so I was going to do that dissertation, and I began to do some research, and I began to reach out, and I reached out to James Cone, and he actually responded, and I told him what I was planning on doing, and he said, "Hey, I thank you for your interest. I'm glad that you would like to do a dissertation on this, but actually, you may want to wait till I finish my book on this, because I'm actually writing a book on this very topic." And I said, "Oh, wow." And so he released the book, a book called The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And I got the book, I read the book, and the book is deals very heavily, as the title may suggest, with lynching and with the American that history of lynching. And as an African American man, you know, this is a deeply painful history for anybody, but especially as an African American man, you know, to read through these accounts of lynching. And Cone is doing a theology that is seeking to talk about the cross as an ancient form of lynching and to connect these two things together: modern lynching and the cross of Christ. And so I read that, but I just remember getting through the book, and I remember after I read the very last page of that book, just sitting there and sort of staring off into space for the next 20 to 30 minutes, you know, just unable to even, it was such a painful subject, such a hard subject. I immediately realized I'm not going to be able to do a dissertation on this topic. I'm just not going to be able to do it. So I went back to my advisor, a guy by the name of Ronald Feenstra, and I asked him, I said, "Dr. Feenstra, I thought I was going to do a dissertation on this. The subject matter is too hard for me. It's just too emotionally painful for me to sit with for an entire dissertation. Is there anything else that you would suggest?" And he looked at me and he said, "Well, how about something on Dr. King?" And when he said that, I thought, okay, you know, here's a guy with a monument on the National Mall. What could there possibly be left or right about his life? You know, it's just like, what hasn't been talked about? You know, I mean, everything's been talked about Dr. King. I mean, is there any area that has, you know, not been uncovered yet about this guy? You know, and so, and I began to go and look, you know, and much to my surprise, there was a whole lot of stuff that nobody's talked about in terms of Dr. King's life, because most people treat Dr. King as just a historical figure, an activist, an ethicist. Very few people were treating him as theologian, right? And so as I looked at him, so my degree is in systematic theology, and so as I looked at him to do a dissertation in systematic theology, and as I looked and engaged King as theologian, there was a huge just areas of his theology that nobody treated, and I found his theodicy and his theodicy, his approach to the problem of evil and suffering, and how suffering can be engaged to the glory of God. That theme was really at the heart of what he was doing in the civil rights movement, and nobody had written nobody had done a book length study on it. In fact, nobody had even done a full chapter on it. Only there had been a single article written by a guy named Rufus Burrow Jr. and he wrote a great article on that, but nobody had ever done a major work on it. So I thought, this is it. I've got something I can do, and then I devoted myself to that topic, and so I wrote my dissertation on King's theodicy.
And one of the things that's interesting about this is that I'm assuming by this time you are already, for lack of a better term, a conservative Christian theologically. I have a close friend, now retired from ministry, but he is an evangelical within a very liberal denomination, the United Methodist Church. And when I would use terms like conservative and liberal, he would say, "Chris, you're not using appropriate terms when it comes to religion. You should say it's either biblical or heretical. Don't use the words conservative and liberal. Those are political terms. Now, I'm not sure I agree with my friend Dr. Dick Williamson on that. But for lack of a better term, you are at this point, are you not, a theological conservative, or what most would view as a theological conservative, and yet you chose a figure from history not necessarily known for theological conservatism.
Right. So, yeah, so at this point, so I think of myself as a Bible-believing Presbyterian. Is that right? I'm an Orthodox Presbyterian church, and the first, you know, that's a mouthful, but the Orthodox is there for a reason. So I think of myself as Orthodox. at least I hope I am. I believe I am. I'm trying to be. that's right. As I went into engaging Dr. King, I really didn't know much about him. I enjoy the benefits of his labors within the civil rights movement as an African American. I think any African American living today can owes a great debt of gratitude to Dr. King and to his labors within the movement. But I really didn't know much about him theologically, other than knowing that he had some liberal leanings. You know, I didn't know much more than that. And so as I began to dig in, right, I was actually really surprised at a number of misconceptions that I had about King, right? One of the misconceptions that I had about King was that I had decontextualized King. You know, so a lot of times when people look at Dr. King, they look at him as if he sort of fell from the sky fully formed, right? You're right, he's just this guy, you know, I mean, they look at King, you know, in 1965 or 66, 67, whatever, and they just feel like this is, you know, he fell out of the sky like this. He fell out of the sky believing in nonviolence and this, that, and the other, and that's not the case at all. His views came about through a process. First of all, his theodicy is the expression of a 300-year redemptive suffering theodical tradition in the black church, within the black church, and within the black community. This is the belief that sustained the African American community and church through 250 years of slavery. I mean, yeah, think about what kind of faith can get people can sustain people in beneath the southern sun and in cotton fields and having had, you know, their members of their family sold off, having seen members of the community sexually assaulted, whipped, beaten, tortured. I mean, and yet these people are able to continue with hope. And you think, what kind of faith must these people have? Well, it's a faith that recognizes that God is able to bring good out of evil circumstances, that God is able to use even our sufferings for the glory of God. And that's not to say that suffering in and of itself is a good, okay, but that God can give us the grace to engage it for our good, and that God can bring about good through the circumstance. And the paradigmatic revelation of that is the cross of Jesus Christ itself, right? So it's at the cross that we get it revealed to us that God is able to bring good out of an evil circumstance, right? And it's at the cross that God opens our eyes to see how we're called to engage our suffering to the glory of God, right? And that's exactly what Peter says to the Christians in Asia Minor in 1 Peter chapter 2, right? I mean, that's exactly what he lays out, right? He says, for to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps, right? And that word example is actually, the Greek word is hupogrammaton, which actually means a writing copy. It's the kind of thing that people in the ancient world would use. It's sort of like dot to dots. When people would use, when they, you know, if you have small children, they have to the way they make, learn to make their letters is that they trace over a dot to dot that gives you the, and it teaches you, for those who don't know how to write, it teaches you how to write, how to form your letters, by going over the pattern. And so what Peter is saying is that when Christ suffered and died, he actually suffered and died, leaving us a pattern to follow. This is the way to engage suffering to the glory of God. And so the African American community had been gripped by that truth. And King himself, right, inherited this redemptive, this crucicentric redemptive suffering theodicy through cultural influences and through church influences. So you can think of the spiritual, right? The spirituals are deeply theodical. The spirituals are an expression of hope in the midst of suffering, right? Spirituals like, did my Lord deliver Daniel, right? Did my Lord deliver Daniel? Did my Lord deliver Daniel? Did my Lord deliver Daniel? And why not every man, right? And so here you have the community of enslaved African Americans here wrestling with the contradictions of life and saying, hey, God delivered Daniel. God delivered Daniel. God was able to do it. Why not every man? Right? So God can deliver me too, right? God can. They're wrestling with the contradictions of life. They're wrestling with theodical questions. And so other ones like there's a balm in Gilead to heal the sin sick soul. There's a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. That kind of musical theodical tradition, and the prayer tradition within the Black church community, and the preaching tradition within the Black church community, all are rich with theodical themes, and not just that, redemptive suffering themes. And that has been the majority report within the community. And King inherited this legacy. And so when he articulates a strategy to engage the communal sufferings of the Black community, you see that it's nonviolent direct action, right? That we're not going to engage our suffering with violence, because when we look at what Christ did in the Garden of Gethsemane and what Christ did at the tree, is that when he was reviled, he didn't revile in return, right? So we're not going to be violent. There were people within the African American community, Black Power Movement, the Nation of Islam, Black militants that were responding with Black suffering through violence. But King realized that that's not the way. That's not the way that Christ has revealed to us. Neither was the way acquiescence. Because if you look in the Garden of Gethsemane, there were folks, you know, think about Peter, right? Peter responded with violence. But then there's another group of folks that just got up and ran. They were acquiescent. They were, you know, there's one brother that just, they said, I call him the naked runner. He was the guy that ran and left his garment behind, you know?
Yeah, Joseph.
That's right. He ran off and left his garment. Well, no, I mean, in the Garden of Gethsemane, John ran off and left his garment behind when the mob came to arrest Christ. And so you had Peter responding with violence. You had John Mark responding with acquiescence. But Jesus shows a third way, right? Jesus does not respond with acquiescence, and he does not respond with violence. He responds with agape action, with nonviolent direct action, right? Engaging his suffering to the glory of God, entrusting himself to him who judges justly. So King recognized this. He recognized that Christ has given us, or he's revealed to us, a way to engage our suffering. And what he did was he simply appropriated that publicly. He said, "Well, how can the church begin to engage its social suffering in this way and witness to the glory of Christ through engaging suffering in this way?" So I think a lot of people, when they look at King and they look at the civil rights movement, they have no idea how this is really rooted in a long tradition and a cross-centered tradition.
Yeah, in fact, we're going to pick up right where you left off when we return from our midway break, which is a longer break than normal, so we can accommodate Grace Life Radio 90.1 FM in Lake City, Florida, who requires a 12-minute gap between our two segments. So anybody else who would like to join us on the air, we still have a list of several people waiting to have their questions asked and answered, and we will get to each and every one of you that time allows us to. And we thank you for waiting this long, but we will eventually get to as many as possible. And don't go away. If you'd like to join us, by the way, and get on that line in case we have time. Our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. But don't go away. God willing, we're going to be right back after these messages from our sponsors.
Tired of box store Christianity, of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Whichever edition you choose, trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnzen, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis, and World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your World trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wng.org/ironsharpens today.
Every day at thousands of community centers, high schools, middle schools, juvenile institutions, coffee shops, and local hangouts, Long Island Youth for Christ staff and volunteers meet with young people who need Jesus. We are rural and urban, and we are always about the message of Jesus. Our mission is to have a noticeable spiritual impact on Long Island, New York, by engaging young people in the lifelong journey of following Christ. Long Island Youth for Christ has been a stalwart bedrock ministry since 1959. We have a world-class staff and a proven track record of bringing consistent love and encouragement to youths in need all over the country and around the world. Help honor our history by becoming a part of our future. Volunteer, donate, pray, or all of the above. For details, call Long Island Youth for Christ at 631-385-8333. That's 631-385-8333. Or visit liyfc.org. That's liyfc.org.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts, We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750, that's 508-528-5750, or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at Providence Baptist Church, ma.org, that's Providence Baptist Church, ma.org, or even on sermonaudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Chef Exclusive Catering is in South Central Pennsylvania. Chef Exclusive's goal is to provide a dining experience that is sure to please any palate. Chef Damian White of Chef Exclusive is a graduate of the renowned Johnson & Wales University with a degree in culinary arts and applied science. Chef Exclusive Catering's event center is newly designed with elegance and style and is available for small office gatherings, bridal showers, engagement parties, and rehearsal dinners. Critics and guests alike acknowledge Chef Exclusive's commitment to exceeding even the highest expectations. I know of their quality firsthand since Chef Exclusive catered my most recent Iron Sharpens Iron Radio Pastor's Luncheon. For details, call 717-388-3000. That's 717-388-3000. Or visit chefexclusive.com. That's chefexclusive.com.
Thrive and Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Welcome back. This is Chris Sarnes, and for those of you who just tuned us in, our guest today for the full 2 hours with a little less than an hour to go is Dr. Micah Edmondson, who earned his Ph.D. in systematic theology at Calvin Theological Seminary, and he's the author of The Power of Unearned Suffering, The Roots and Implications of Martin Luther King Jr.'s Theodicy. He's also a pastor at New City Fellowship Orthodox Presbyterian Church of Grand Rapids, Michigan. We have been discussing and will continue to discuss Martin Luther King Jr., an open, honest evaluation of his life, legacy, and theology. Before I return to our discussion, I have some important announcements to make regarding events that our sponsors are having. The Fellowship Conference New England is being held August 3rd through the 5th in Reverend Buzz Taylor's old stomping grounds, Maine, and this specifically will be at the Deering Center Community Church of Portland, Maine, and the speakers include Pastor Don Curran, who is the Eastern European Coordinator with Heart Cry Missionary Society, the organization founded by Paul Washer. My dear friend, Pastor Mac Tomlinson, who is an author and also the pastor of Providence Chapel in Denton, Texas. Pastor Jesse Barrington, who is the pastor of Grace Life Church in Dallas, Texas, the sister church of Grace Life Church in Lake City, Florida, whose radio station airs Iron Sharpens Iron Radio every day in a pre-recorded form, and Pastor Nate Pickowitz, who is not only the pastor of Harvest Bible Church in Gilmanton Iron Works, New Hampshire, but he's also the author of Reviving New England and Why We're Protestant. If you'd like to register for this conference, go to fellowshipconferencenewengland.com, fellowshipconferencenewengland.com. And then our friends at the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals are going to be holding their Quakertown Conference on Reformed Theology November 17th through the 18th, God willing, in Quakertown, Pennsylvania at the Grace Bible Fellowship Church of Quakertown. The speakers include Kent Hughes, Peter Jones, Tom Nettles, Dennis Cahill, and Scott Oliphant, and the theme is For Still Our Ancient Foe, a line from Martin Luther's classic hymn, A Mighty Fortress, and of course our ancient foe being Satan. If you would like to register for this conference, go to alliancenet.org, alliancenet.org, click on events, and then click on Quakertown Conference on Reformed Theology. And God willing, I will have an exhibitor's booth for Iron Sharpens Iron Radio there. And then coming up in January from the 17th through the 20th, the G3 Conference returns to Atlanta, Georgia. The theme is Knowing God, a Biblical Understanding of Discipleship. On the 17th, it is exclusively a Spanish-speaking edition of the G3 Conference. And then from the 18th through the 20th is the English-speaking conference. And the speakers include Stephen Lawson, Vody Balcom, Phil Johnson, Keith Getty, H.B. Charles Jr., Tim Challies, Josh Bice, James White, Tom Askell, Anthony Mathenia, Michael Kruger, David Miller, Paul Tripp, Todd Friel, Derek Thomas, and Martha Peace. If you'd like to register for the G3 Conference, go to g3conference.com, g3conference.com. When registering for any of these events, or even if you're just contacting the organizations running them to find out more information, please let all of them know that you heard about the events on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And last but not least comes that very unpleasant task that I have, is to grub money from you. The advertisers of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio who have kept my program afloat sacrificially and very generously by advertising on the program, they urged me and have continued to urge me to make public appeals to you, the listener, to donate whenever possible to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, and also to advertise with us if you have a business, a corporation, a professional practice, a church or a parachurch ministry, or a special event that you want to promote, as long as whatever it is you're advertising is compatible with the theological makeup of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. The website is ironsharpensironradio.com. Click on support. You'll receive or you will see a mailing address where you can make a check made payable to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio for any amount and mail it to that address that you see when you click support. And if you want to advertise, just send me an email to chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com and put advertising in the subject line. And I have to say, I've been very blessed by the answer to prayer, because for the last 4 or 5 days, every day I'm getting somebody emailing me questions about advertising with us. So I'm very delighted about that. And for those of you who have contributed financially to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I know that some of you are even regularly now donating to us. And always remember, never, ever, ever siphon money out of your regular giving to your local church where you are a member. And if you're not a member of a local Bible-believing church, you better correct that very quickly. If you are a member of a church and you're giving to that church regularly, please never siphon money out of that giving, and never take food off of your family's dinner table if you're struggling to make ends meet. Providing for your church and providing for your family are two commands of God. Providing for Iron Sharpens Iron Radio is not a command of God, but if you are blessed above and beyond your ability to fulfill your obligations in providing for your church and home, please consider Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. If the show blesses you, if it's a part of your regular habit of life, if it has benefited you in any way, then a donation of any amount would be greatly appreciated. We are now back to our discussion with Dr. with Dr. Micah Edmondson on Martin Luther King Jr., an open and honest evaluation of his life, legacy, and theology. Before we go to any of our listener questions, Dr. Edmondson, do you have any additional things to say about Dr. King's approach to the theodicy before we have perhaps some questions asked in a more critical fashion about his theology?
Well, yeah, you know, actually I was going to just sort of get into some of that because I was assuming that, you know, because, you know, this is a, you know, it's a critical engagement of King. And so, you know, as some people say, I've had told me, hey, you know, you eat the meat and spit out the bones. You know, there are some issues, you know, some major issues that we contend with as we grapple with the life and legacies and oftentimes, sometimes even the theologies of our of heroes and of fallen people. You know, so with King, it's no different. King. One of the misconceptions that I had about King, though, was that he was thoroughgoing liberal. That he was. This is what I sort of came into it thinking. You know, King is a thoroughgoing liberal, and he. I thought to myself, okay, he goes to Crozier Divinity School in Boston University, and he becomes a liberal, and that's just it. You know, and I didn't realize that King's sort of theological journey was more complicated than that. And in fact, it was much more like a cycle than just a straight shot. You know, he grew up in going to Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, under the pastorate of his father, Martin Luther King Sr., Daddy King. And Daddy King was, I think you mentioned conservative earlier. Daddy King was conservative, Bible-believing, Bible-preaching, right down the line, pastor.
Yeah, I saw a film about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I believe it was a film made for television, and James Earl Jones played Daddy King, and he came across like a real strict fundamentalist type of Baptist preacher.
That's right. In fact, that's the term that King Jr. would use about his father when he went off to Morehouse College, right? So King, so at 15 years old, King goes off to Morehouse College and actually is having a crisis of faith. He almost repudiated the faith, almost left the faith at Morehouse College, deeply ashamed of the what he called the fundamentalistic religion of his father and of their church. And when he got to Morehouse, for the first couple of years, he was really moving towards skepticism until he encountered a man by the name of George Kelsey, who had an intro to the Bible class at Morehouse College, and Kelsey was applying the Bible and the truths of Scripture to the black social situation. Now, this is one of the big issues for King. King was wondering, does the Bible have anything to say to the sufferings of African Americans? And Kelsey began to show that to King in a way that was more intellectually satisfying for King. And that is when King began to sort of imbibe liberalism, okay? But he imbibed it critically because George Kelsey imbibed it critically. Right, so this was a critical engagement with liberalism. There were some aspects of liberalism that African Americans in the segregated South could not countenance, namely the low view of sin. Right, so if you're an African American in the segregated South, you have a very hard time with a low view of sin, you know, because you have come face to face with some of the worst of human depravity when you. When you're getting reports of lynching in your community, right? You know that human nature is not basically good; that there is something deeply flawed with human nature, with fallen human nature. That is post fall. Now, I'm not talking about us in our creation,
right.
But since the fall, right?
Total depravity.
Total depravity. That's exactly right. So. Sin touches every area of the human existence, and it runs to our very core. And so King recognized just his black experience, his experience as African American in the segregated South, sort of thrust that upon him. You know, he couldn't deny that. So that was a part of liberalism that he rejected, its low view of sin. Another part of liberalism that he rejected was its low view of the power of God. Because if you're an African American in the segregated South in the 50s and the 60s, or you know, the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, you know that you need a God that is omnipotent and able to deliver you from the sufferings all around you. You know, and so anyone that comes along with a theology that proposes a God that's anything less than able is going to be deeply problematic. And so so when King presented with various theologies like theistic finitism, the theistic finitism of a guy named Edgar Sheffield Brightman would have been deeply attractive to King, because King was Brightman was someone who helped to pioneer a philosophy called personalism. And this was a philosophy that deeply valued human personality and personality in general. It thought of personality as the fundamental reality of the universe. And it gave philosophical categories to affirm the dignity of personhood. Okay, and so this was very attractive to King, because King was looking for resources to affirm the full humanity of African Americans and the dignity of African Americans. And so the philosophy of personalism was one that he deeply gravitated to. And so Edgar Sheffield Brightman was like the leading personalist of the day. So he wanted to study with Brightman. But then when he was confronted with Brightman's view of God as being finite and unable to bring about the full realization of God's will, right? Brightman had a view that although God was omnibenevolent, that God was not quite omnipotent, that there was something within God himself that keeps God from fully realizing his will.
Like open theism?
So open theism is might be described as a kind of theistic finitism, but what it does is it actually lays the constraint on God's knowledge, right? So God doesn't know everything. God, you know, that open theism would postulate that God is learning as God goes, that kind of thing, right? So this is a constraint on God's power. God wants to do good, but he's just not able to pull it off because there's something within God's own nature that keeps him from fulfilling it. And so King thought that this actually set up a dualism within God himself. And as an African American in the segregated South and dealing with a whole lot of suffering, King says, no, I cannot countenance the idea that God is not able to deliver us. God must be able to deliver us. God must be able to make a way out of no way. Right? That's a black church idiom that deals with that actually affirms the biblical belief in the God that is able to save his people, right? So that's also a part of liberalism that King rejected. But there were parts of liberalism that King did imbibe, okay? And this has to be clearly, that has to be just asserted, right? I'm not denying that at all. I'm not saying that the picture is one of complete orthodoxy and there's no problematic elements here. I mean, there's some things about King where he denied things like the virgin birth at times. When he was a young boy, he denied the literal resurrection from the dead. Okay, and so he was as much a liberal in his young days as, you know, Abraham Kuyper was in his young days, right? So, I'm not trying to drag Kuyper into this, but
I know Kuyper was actually led to Christ, to a saving relationship with Christ as a preacher. He was already a pastor.
As a pastor, that's right. That's right. This brother was as lost could be in seminary, and he came to faith as a pastor, right? So King had some very problematic views in seminary, but it was during his days in the civil rights movement. Okay, so he takes a pastor at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. The Montgomery bus boycott begins in 1955. And only in just a few months into the bus boycott, everyone sort of thought that initially the folks involved in the boycott in Montgomery, they thought this was going to last a day. Okay, we're going to boycott for a day, and the folks are going to see the error of their ways, and this thing is going to be over. But no, a day turned into weeks, weeks turned into months. Okay, and King began to receive death threats, upwards to 40 death threats a day. He received all kinds of various forms of intimidation, and here he is as a young pastor, 27 years old, newly married, a young daughter, just a few months old, and on January 27th, 1956, he receives a call in the middle of the night. His wife, Coretta, was already asleep, and he receives a call that threatened his life, another call that threatened his life. Now, normally, he was able to kind of shrug this kind of thing off, but for some reason, this particular call that was threatening to bomb his house in 3 days if he didn't leave town and to kill his family, some kind of way, for some reason, this thing got to him. I mean, this particular call, whatever it was, it just got to him, and he couldn't get back to sleep. And he told this story throughout his life about this kitchen visit. So he went to his kitchen, and he gets a cup of coffee, and he's thinking that the coffee is going to help him through the night, and he's going to be able to get back to sleep. But he just could not shake this off. He was afraid. He was weak, and he was ready to quit. He was ready to give up the movement. Now, keep in mind, this is just 2 months into the bus boycott. Okay, he's 27 years old, and he's already about to give up the whole deal. You know, and then. He tells the story. This reflects on the trajectory, the cycle that I told you about. And this is what he says. I'm just gonna read a little bit of it. It's just a paragraph here. But I think it's worth quoting. I don't want to get his words wrong. He says, "Then I got up and went back to the kitchen and started warming some coffee, thinking that coffee would give me a little relief." And then he says, "Then I started thinking about many things." And then he says this. He says, "I pulled back on the theology and philosophy that I had just studied in the university." He's talking about his liberal theology that he had studied in university, trying to give philosophical and theological reasons for the existence and the reality of sin and evil. But the answer didn't quite come there. And he says, "Then I got to the point where I couldn't take it any longer. I was weak. And something said to me, 'You can't call on Daddy now. He's up in Atlanta, 175 miles away. You can't even call on Mama now. You've got to call on that something and that person that your daddy used to tell you about, that power that can make a way out of no way.'" And he says, "And I bowed down over that cup of coffee. I never will forget it. Oh, yes, and I prayed a prayer." He says, "And I prayed out loud that night." Okay, and it was after that that he gains renewed strength to actually face the challenges that came to him. And he would oftentimes refer to that kitchen, the so-called kitchen vision, talk about how he continued on in the movement. But I want you to notice what he says, that he says, "I pulled back on the theology and philosophy that I had just studied at universities, trying to give philosophical and theological reasons for the existence and reality of sin and evil, but the answers didn't quite come there." Okay, so what King is saying is, I'm not saying that he's repudiating everything he got in the seminary and everything he got sort of coming through and his liberalism, but I want you to notice the step. When he got to Morehouse, he sort of steps away from the theology that he got growing up, and it's his Bible, what we might call his conservative theology, and that kind of system of belief that was inherited from his father and in his church. And he begins to imbibe liberalism critically, but he begins to imbibe it. Now, when he gets into this situation in 1956, and he's at his lowest moment, and he's got to draw on some resources, and he's got to lean on something, and he says, "I could not lean on this liberalism. It didn't sustain me. It would not give me the answers I needed." And then he says he called on the God that his father taught him about. Now, that's the God that is omnipotent. right? That's the God that is omniscient. That's the God that makes the way out of the way. And that's the God whose son is Jesus Christ, crucified and risen from the dead. That's the God, you know. So this is the, so he makes a shift, okay? So, and here's the thing. This is after King had really done much of his kind of theological writing, his kind of, you know, his, you know, so he wrote a bunch of stuff in seminary, and after he left seminary, what we get from King is sermons, we get speeches, we get, you know, newspaper articles, things that don't necessarily articulate and expound all the finer points of his theology, okay? What we know is that he eventually goes back to Ebenezer Baptist Church and serves alongside his father, that conservative Bible-preaching pastor at Ebenezer, as an assistant pastor at Ebenezer, over Christian education.
Wow.
1960, he goes back to Ebenezer, and he's over, and he says when he gets back there, he says, I want to teach the people about our faith. They need to understand the system of doctrine of our faith. And his commitment is actually to teach them about our faith. Now, see, here's the thing. I don't know everything he taught in those Sunday school classes as he went back to Ebenezer Baptist Church, but I strongly suspect that if he was serving alongside Daddy King, he wasn't teaching them that to deny the virgin birth and that Jesus didn't raise from the dead.
Right.
You know, so, go ahead.
I was just going to say that you know, you're enlightening me to some things that I didn't know before. Let me tell you where I have been predominantly in my life as a Christian after becoming born again and becoming more understanding of biblical theology and so on. When I read an autobiography of religious development, which is something that King wrote among his other papers that is archived at Stanford University, he denied more than virgin birth. He even denied the deity of Christ completely, and he denied the bodily resurrection. He denied the substitutionary atonement of Christ. And what I came to conclude at that time was that a Christian should view King as an American hero, because he bravely did fight for the equal rights of all humans, regardless of race, and risked his own life to do so because he knew he was definitely under the threat of death, and then eventually that came to fruition. He was murdered. And in spite of any flaws in his life, the man should be revered as an American hero by people of all religions, if you're American patriots. But I always had a problem after discovering the theology that he wrote about, having a Christian view him as a Christian hero, just as I would not want Christians to view Thomas Jefferson as a Christian hero, or Benjamin Franklin as a Christian hero, or you can think of countless other American heroes that you learn about in elementary school and high school that were heroes but not Christian heroes. In order to preserve the purity of the gospel and not venture into misleading young and old into thinking that those types of theological beliefs are ever tolerable or acceptable within the Christian faith, I became very concerned about people identifying him as a Christian hero and one that should be imitated even in matters of faith and practice, obviously, in regard to the confines of Christianity and the responsibilities of a disciple of Christ. Now, how would you, if at all, respond negatively to what I just said?
Okay, so I would say this. So the Autobiography of Religious Development is a paper that King writes at Crozier Divinity School. He writes this for George Washington Davis, where he basically goes back and talks about the sort of the roots of his intellectual and theological development. Okay, and at that time, now in that paper, now he doesn't do everything that you just mentioned in that paper. But if you look at the King, if you look at Volume 1 of the King papers, There are various places in which you can find King doing things like arguing against penal substitutionary atonement or vicarious substitutionary atonement. You can find him doing things like that in various papers, not just in that one. You know, it's not all in that one paper, but throughout various papers, you can see him making moves like that. So I would say this. I would say, I look at King very much like sort of like what I mentioned with Abraham Kuyper, and I brought Kuyper up for a reason, because I brought him up because I think, people are able to sort of look at his legacy and say, yes, this is a statesman, okay, but there's people that draw down on him theologically, okay, and they don't necessarily say that because in his early life he held views and espoused views that are flat out heretical, that later on in his life, okay, he's, that you sort of throw his entire life away and say, well, there's nothing we can learn from Kuyper. We shouldn't get anything from this guy because when he was at seminary, he said this, So I look at King as someone who, what that kitchen vision does for me is it says to, and to hear King say things like, and I try to draw down on this stuff I got from my liberal seminaries, and then I ended up going back to the person that my father told me about. That tells me that in his core, in his gut, sort of when you peel back the onion, okay, what you get is someone who is expressing the faith of the Black church tradition, right? And that is a very conservative theological tradition. And the person that King's daddy told him about was the person that was preached in fundamentalistic churches, right? So now if the question is, if the issue becomes, okay, well, is King in heaven or not? Well, you didn't ask me that, but the question of King's place on those doctrines later in his life is unanswered, because King didn't do the same kinds of writings later in his life that he did early in his life. But what we can tell is that he did make a shift, right, and that he functioned within a setting that was deeply conservative theologically, and that he taught Sunday school in that setting. Okay, and so I would say that King. So in that sense, I would say from what we can get, we can sort of looking at his life sort of charitably, and sort of looking at what he seems to say in terms of his sort of liberal background, he seems to, again, what he said at Crozier Seminary, that wasn't the final say in his life always, and it just goes to show you that, when you really shook the tree and he really got down to the roots of who he was, he was a Black Baptist preacher that came out of the Black Baptist tradition and is expressing the faith of the Black Baptist tradition. It functioned within that setting, So, I think the most we can say is that that his particular views on those particular points of doctrine is undetermined. We don't know for sure. I don't know. As a king, as a person that's read a lot of King stuff, and early in his life and later on in his life, you look at his life and he says certain things in seminary, but then he sort of repudiates those things in some ways and sort of makes a shift. And then he functions in a setting that would have never tolerated those views. And honestly, man, I saw, and this is no excuse for King, but it just gives you a clearer view into sort of what his mindset was at seminary. And there's some things that he said at seminary that I know he didn't believe. Like, sometimes that he talks about theistic finitism, and he kind of agrees with Edgar Sheffield Brightman when he gets in Brightman's class. He's, oh, well, this, like, theistic finitism stuff, this seems to make sense. I think this is acceptable. But then after that, he says, no, this is not acceptable. We cannot, you know, this is not a acceptable view of God, you know. So, you think, okay, here's a guy that's in Brightman's class, and maybe he's saying what he feels like the professor wants to hear. I don't know, you know, but I know that the question of King's theology is a lot more complicated than people oftentimes want to admit or accept, you know. So now the question, so if it comes down to can we learn anything from King, I think we can. There's no doubt in my mind that we can learn a whole lot from King, especially in terms of his practice, right? Of his if part of the litmus test of Christian orthodoxy, right, and whether or not we love the Lord is whether we love people made in his image, then King is a great example, okay? You know, I mean, because when the scripture talks and gives us the litmus test and says, okay, well, how do we know we love the Lord who we haven't seen? Well, it's by whether or not we love our neighbor who we can see, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, how do the scripture oftentimes uses the second table of the law, what we might call sort of the ethical expressions of the law, as a way to judge our commitment to the first table, right? So the epistemological part of the law, whether or not we actually love the Lord, and whether or not that being said, I mean, King, I think, was real strong on orthopraxis, okay, and right practice, you know, and that doesn't mean that, you know, you get into heaven by right practice, right? We get into heaven by faith in Christ alone.
Amen.
So
I know that anybody listening who would take a completely militant view against what you're saying, you better throw away all the books written by Christians about Teddy Roosevelt and any other figures that you love, that there's no basis to believe that they were biblically orthodox Christians, and that Christians do learn from the lives of figures from history, notable figures from history that left us an example and a lesson to learn, or many lessons to learn, even if they weren't necessarily born-again believers.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So again, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, now I'll speak as a minister from the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. At the end of the day, you know, our book of church order actually prevents us from putting people in heaven or not. Right, like if you do a funeral,
I think
the church order says you cannot put someone, you know, you can't pronounce on whether or not this person is.
Well, I think God removed that power from us from the beginning.
I'm simply saying, you know, exactly right. I mean, even higher authority. That's right. That's exactly right. The Lord alone reserves that right. Christ alone knows whether or not King had true saving faith, I think we can learn a lot. You know, again, we take the meat, spit out the bones. I think we can learn a lot from the life and legacy of King. We can learn what not to do. We can learn some things that could challenge us in terms of what we can do. And any figure that's fallen, any figure other than Christ, is that way. Right, that's part of the thing, right? So.
And even those that, for whatever reason, they had to oppose King is known perhaps only to them, and it might even been racist issues. But even those folks owe a debt to him because of his stand for peaceful protest, because their lives may have been prevented from being snuffed out or at least greatly injured or what have you, or the lives of their loved ones, because, as you said earlier, there were other groups such as the Nation of Islam and the Black Panthers and others that were calling for violence.
No question about it. But I want you to we got to recognize, though, that King's stand for nonviolence and for his stand for the equal dignity and worth, not only of African Americans, but also of poor people and of everybody, was orthopraxy that actually reflected on doctrine. Okay, because you see, so what is the underlying belief system that supported segregation, right? Unless it was ethno-nationalism and superiority, it was ethnic superiority, right? The belief system that says, okay, you black people get to the back of the bus, right? You cannot drink at the same water fountains as us. You must get in the back of the bus. You can't go to the same schools as us. This is a belief system that supported the ontological inferiority of African Americans, and that is fundamentally pagan.
Yes.
Okay. That belief system is fundamentally pagan.
Which is why the Apostle Paul had to rebuke Peter publicly, because he was guilty of the same kind of racism. This was a racism against Gentiles, being a Jewish person himself. But I do.
Exactly. And notice what he said, though. What Paul said when he rebuked it, he said, what you are doing is out of step with the gospel.
Right.
He made it into a gospel issue because what Peter was doing was a form of legalism. It asserted that his ethnic, Jewish, ethnic, cultural identity was a currency of acceptance before God. That if these Gentiles, if they want to be accepted by God, then they have to come into our cultural milieu, and they have to assimilate to our cultural trappings. They have to take on circumcision. They have to take on our dietary code. They have to be like us in order to get close to God. And so that is a form of legalism, and that undermines the gospel, because the gospel says that Christ alone is the currency of our acceptance before God. That's the fundamental in the Church of Galatia. It's the same thing you see in the Table of Nations in Genesis chapter 10, right? Because the Table of Nations lays out the nations, the origin of the nations that spread out throughout the world after the flood, right? And it asserts that all the nations were spread out from this one man, Noah, and his three sons. And that was a revolutionary revelation at the time that the Lord gave it, and even today. Because every other nation around the nation of Israel, every other nation in the ancient Mesopotamian world, believed that their nation was founded first. Their myth said that their nation was founded first, so that they had ontological superiority over everyone else. And so so the belief in ethnic superiority is not just unkind or rude, or it's actually pagan, right? And so what King is doing is he's actually confronting a form of paganism in the culture, okay? And so he's not just doing something that, this is a positive benefit sort of socially for people. If you think that's all that was going on, you're actually missing the deeper picture here.
Right, and we're
confronting. Yeah, go ahead.
And I just want to say, I want to try to get to some of our listener questions before we run out of time.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. Go ahead.
No, that's quite all right. We have a listener who's a Reformed Baptist in Nigeria, Lagos, Nigeria. And I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, Osinachi, but it's either, I'm guessing, Osinachi or Osinaki. He says, Dear Chris, I saw today's topic and decided I'd listen live so that I can send in a question, because I've been often troubled by the way some Christians regard Martin Luther King Jr. Here's my questions. Should men be revered no matter how momentous they are if they err in vital and fundamental areas of God's word? That's one of two questions Osinachi has.
That's a good question. Well, it depends on what you mean by revered, right? I mean, honestly, if the question is, should we honor the legacy of King, or should we respect him as someone who made a positive contribution to our society and even to the way in which we think theologically? I think yes. I think you'd be hard pressed to say this guy has nothing to say socially and this guy has nothing to say theologically. I think I've attempted to show, even through his theodicy, his redemptive suffering theodicy, and how it was a public appropriation of the theology of the cross, how actually that's a positive thing that the church could actually get today and use then, right, to engage suffering. So we can certainly gain things theologically and certainly socially in terms of looking at the life of King. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have to take him whole, but there's certainly tremendous things that we can learn from it.
And Osinachi's second question is, I hear things like Black Theology by Americans of African Heritage. As an African living in a multi-tribal society, this bothers me a great deal. Could your guests please shed light on why this is the case, even among those of a reformed persuasion?
Okay. So Black Liberation Theology was a theological expression of the Black Power movement that came about in 1969, okay? But here's the thing. What Cone was doing was he was actually filling a vacuum, okay? Because many American theologians, okay, and in the history of theology in America, have oftentimes found ways to resist engaging the issue of Black suffering theologically, okay? And so the sad thing is it took the liberals to do this, right? Because it took the liberals to actually offer a theology that speaks to the issues, the daily issues of Black suffering, okay? And, you know, and I just want you to think about it. Think about the kind of theology that could comfortably exist with slavery and Jim Crow and lynching and segregation. That is a theology that, and I'll just speak for the Reformed tradition here. The tradition that was handed down from the Reformers was not a tradition that could comfortably exist with those things. It was a tradition that actually, if it had been applied in the way that it was handed down, would have radically challenged those institutions, right? There's a resource called The Baptism of Early Virginia, in which a scholar named Rebecca Getz talks about how Southern planters re-engineered the doctrine of Christian baptism. These were Anglicans. They re-engineered the doctrine of Christian baptism in order to accommodate the racial caste system in America, because they were so threatened by the tradition that was handed to them. Same thing that happened in the Southern Presbyterian churches, right? So the doctrine of spirituality of the church was engineered, right? Thornwell and Dad, they engineered this thing because there was the obvious question of what does our theology have to say to this institution of slavery? So they had to actually go in. So if you know, you don't have to change something unless you perceive a threat, you know? Black theology, if you want to talk about Black theology, it's just theology that's applied to the Black social situation, okay? That can be done well and it can be done poorly.
And I'm assuming I have a feeling, I'm getting a gut reaction or gut instinct, I should say, that Osinachi is thinking that by using terms like that, we are saying there are different gospels for different people that involve their skin color. I may be wrong on that, but since he seemed to be so very dismayed by this concept.
Okay, right. Well, you know, I would just say, Black Liberation Theology, right? I think that Black Liberation Theology takes up great questions and offers very poor answers. Okay, and I think that that Orthodox theologians that love the Lord, love the Bible, I would love, you know, we need more theologians, African American and otherwise, to apply the resources from the Reformed tradition and from the Scriptures to the issues of Black suffering today. And I think we'd be surprised at what we would get if we would do that. So, by Black theology, we mean just the resources from the Reformed tradition or biblical orthodoxy applied to the issues of Black suffering. I think we need a whole lot of that. I think we need more of that, right?
Years ago, right after the book came out, I think, it might have been a year or so after the book came out, but I interviewed Anthony Bradley in the old Iron Sharpens Iron on his critique of Black Liberation Theology. Are you familiar with Anthony Bradley's work on that?
I'm not familiar with his work. I'm familiar with Bradley. I'm not familiar with his work on that. I know the book is out there. I hadn't read the book yet. So, I know the greatest critique of Cone's work came from his brother, actually. Cecil Cone wrote a book right after James Cone wrote his book in 1969, Cecil Cone writes a book in 1971 called Crisis, Identity Crisis of African American, of Black Theology, okay? And Cecil Cone basically says to his brother, James Cone, your black theology is not black enough, right? And the reason he says it is he's like, because Cone is drawing on Western European theological resources, right? So he's drawing on Karl Barth, he's in Anglo-American research, he's drawing on Barth, he's drawing on Niebuhr, he's drawing on all these sources. And what Cecil Cone is saying is, hey, you're not drawing on the resources from your own, sort of church tradition, you know? And if he had, his theology would have been much more rooted in the Bible, because the black church is a very Bible-centered tradition, you know? this is one of the reasons why King, you know, sort of, you know, because he was like, man, this is so, you know, he called it sort of fundamentalistic. I mean, it's very rooted in the tradition. So, yeah.
By the way, I want to let, it's interesting, as the time has elapsed, three of our listeners who sent in questions, all of their questions were answered by you already. We have Daniel in San Jose, California. Thank you for your questions. And if you've been listening, you know they've been answered. Tyler in Mastic Beach, Long Island, New York, your question has been answered. The question, perhaps you could reiterate something that is being asked by our listener in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. His name is Gordy, and I know that you've already touched on this, but perhaps since we are running out of time, some people might have missed your answer to this. But Gordy in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, I have to enlarge his email because the font is microscopic. He says, while attending Crozer Theological Seminary in 1960, Dr. King wrote regarding the resurrection of Christ, the external evidence for the authenticity of this doctrine is found wanting. Was this the prevailing theological perspective, or was there change later on in his life? Perhaps you could reiterate what you were saying before.
Yeah, so I was saying that I believe that a change happened later on in his life, based on, that vision in the kitchen that he has, and he's not at Crozier in 1960. Okay, by that time he had long graduated from Crozier and Boston University. But in 1956, January 1956, he has his vision. He makes a step back to depending on, trusting on, leaning on the God that makes a way out of no way, the God that his father preached. In 1960, King does go back to Ebenezer Baptist Church. He takes up the charge of teaching Christian doctrine within the Sunday school program of Ebenezer Baptist Church as an associate pastor. And in terms of his beliefs about the resurrection itself, there's a great sermon that he preached called Questions That Easter Answers, where he affirms very clearly his belief in the physical bodily resurrection.
Really?
Just look at it. You can find it online. Questions That Easter Answers.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, one thing that even conservatives will quote King on today, conservatives who may be dismayed at some of the media that seems to be not only dominated by liberalism, but sometimes it seems to be totalitarian leftism, where people are being subject to reverse racism. King said that we're not supposed to be judging people according to the color of the skin, but according to the content of their character. And that's something that obviously people of all persuasions should be firm believers in, that kind of mantra.
Mm-hmm. No question about it.
And one thing that I'd like to ask you, hinted at this when we were having a private conversation before the program. I really enjoyed the way that this program was handled. I hope you did as well. There are people out there that and I'm sure that you have seen this or heard this, that would jump on anyone, especially if they happen to be white, like I am, for offering any kind of criticism or evaluation or critique of Dr. King's theology or anything about him for that matter, and it is automatically presumed that my motives or the motives of a white Christian or a white person of any background, the presumption is that the motivation is racism. I'm hoping that you would see that that is can be a very slanderous thing, although that might be somebody's motive, and often has been throughout the history of the United States, starting with the Civil Rights Movement and when King came on the scene and after his assassination. There are obviously many racists who have vilified him and everything about him, but don't you think that open, honest critique as a Christian is not only appropriate, but it's mandated, really? I mean, when you think of the Apostle Paul, he was not upset, even though he was an apostle, when the Bereans were examining what he believed and testing every word that came out of his mouth according to the scriptures. Aren't we supposed to do that with any revered hero, especially with anybody that comes to us that has influence, that has some kind of a religious message or a message of any import on society? Aren't we supposed to be testing their words according to the Bible?
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I think we can. I think we are called to do that. I think that we're called. I think, you know, there's a particular way in which we do it. You know, if you look at so the ninth commandment, right? You shall not bear false witness.
Right.
We have a wonderful articulation in the Westminster Larger Catechism on not only the things forbidden by the ninth commandment, but the duties required by the ninth commandment. And part of one of the things that are that's sort of forbidden is is sinful overcriticism, right? So when we begin to approach a person assuming the worst about the person, or we begin to approach the person with an intent to sort of undermine their reputation or disparage them, then we're actually violating the ninth commandment, right? We actually have a duty to resist an evil report. That's part of what. That's part of the language of the Westminster Larger Catechism on the Ninth Commandment. That is really our responsibility. So when we hear about something, it's not that we need to be naive and denying that if a person has sinned, then we need to be able to admit that, and we need to not dismiss it or downplay it. But nevertheless, we need to try to love believes all things. We need to have a desire to want to assume the best about the person, and a desire to want to protect their reputation. So I think that any engagement with a figure or with anyone else, the most charitable way to deal with them would be in trying to trying to do what we can to protect their reputation and try to do what we can to assume the best while also being honest in terms of what we see before us. So. That's what I would say.
Great. Well, I want to make sure that our listeners have the website for Roman and Littlefield Publishers. It is Roman, that's spelled R-O-W-M-A-N.com, R-O-W-M-A-N.com. And they have informed us that if you order the book, it's quite an expensive book, as most doctoral dissertations are when they come into print, especially with an academic publisher. The code to use to get 30% off is LEX30AUTH17. That's LEX30AUT, as in Thomas, H17, and you'll get a 30% off. And I want also people to know that if you live in Grand Rapids, Michigan, or near there, or you plan to visit there, or you have family and friends and loved ones that either live there or plan to visit there, the website for New City Fellowship Orthodox Presbyterian Church is newcitygr.org. That's newcitygr.org. That stands for New City Grand Rapids .org. Is there any other contact information you care to give Dr. Edmondson for our listeners?
I think that's pretty much it. I mean, we do have a Facebook page, so you can look us up on Facebook. I have a personal Twitter account, and it's just my name, Micah Edmondson, that's not the church Twitter account, but that's just sort of my personal Twitter account. if they want to engage, you know, with me around issues regarding King or whatever. But that's pretty much it. I really appreciate the opportunity, Chris. It's been a real blessing, and I hope that it serves your listeners well.
Great. Well, if you could hold on a minute, I'd actually like to schedule you for another interview at some point. If you could hold on.
All right. Wonderful.
Great. And I want to thank everybody who listened, especially those who took the time to write in. I'm sorry that we stole your thunder and answered your questions before you wrote in. But I want you all to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner.